Recording has started. Please go ahead.
Thank you very much. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening to everyone. Welcome to the Privacy and Proxy Services Accreditation Issues PDP Working Group call on Tuesday, the 29th of September at 1400 UTC. On today's call, we have Todd Williams, Frank Mishlick, Steve Metallic, Sarah Wild, Chris Pelling, Val Sherman, Kathy Kleiman, Graham Bunton, Stephen Trick, Carlton Samuels, Holly Rose, Rudy Vonsnick, Chris Dawson, John Blumenthal, Alex Deacon, Osvaldo Novoa, Roger Carney, Sarah Brockie, Lindsay Hamilton-Reed, James Gannon, Darcy Sarwell, Southwell, Suzanne Kawaguchi. Apologies today noted from Phil Corwin and possibly James Bladel if he is not able to join the call. From staff we have Mary Wong and myself, Gisela Gruber. And if I could please remind everyone to please state their names when speaking purposes. Thank you. And if anyone does join the call during the recording, their participation will be noted, and I will let you know on the Adobe. And over to you, Graham. Thank you.
Thank you, Tiny. Okay. As per usual, anyone have updates to their SOI before we get started? Kathy is saying echo. I'm very faint, apparently, so let me get closer to my mic. How's that?
Better. Yay.
Great. Okay. So what are we going to do today? We are going to take a look at Annex E. We're going to hear back from Subteam 4, and then if we've got time, we're going to look at some of the issues we've noted previously. Now, we haven't had long with the Annex E document. I think Mary sent it out yesterday. And I'm not clear whether it was Mary that made some of those edits or whether that was the sub-team that did so. And I see Mary's hand up, which is great. So, Mary, if you want to let us know who made those, and then we can go through some of those changes, I think, and have some discussion.
Sure. Thanks, Graham. And hi, everybody. This is Mary from staff. Thanks, of course, to Subteam 3 for continuing to work through this document. So what this document is, the one that was sent out yesterday that you see on the screen, is an update made by staff based on, first of all, the continuing subteam discussions, including, second of all, the working group discussion of the earlier draft from about 2 weeks ago. So what I wanted to note for those of you who haven't had a chance to look through this 28th September draft is that while some comments were put into this, there wasn't a whole lot of textual changes. So it might be easy, given that you can't actually see the comment balloons in Adobe Connect. Obviously, if you pull up the document on your own screen, you can. We've put into the right-hand side notes part, hopefully you can see that, the comments and the changes. And the last thing I'll say, Graham, before putting it back to you, is that there were only a few textual changes. They were all in Section 3B, and they've been grouped together in that right-hand side notes part. As for those comments, which are also in this notes part, those are the comments that came from the working group discussion of 2 weeks ago, and the subteam has had a few discussions via email since then, and I assume that they would want to take the working group through some of those outstanding issues. Thanks, Graham.
Thank you, Mary. Great. So maybe we move to, is Todd on the call? I see Todd, who's got his hand up. Kathy's also in on this one. Todd, if you want to talk us through some of the discussions that you guys have been having and the changes we've seen in this document.
Right, sure. So as Mary said, We had a good discussion in the last time we talked about this document in the broader working group, which was the September 15th call. But in that call also identified several areas that needed further discussion. So just to kind of go in order through the document, the first is 1B3. And just to kind of set the table on that, the only substantive discussion we had about that section on the September 15th call was to say that we had removed it per the majority of the public comments that we reviewed were against it as opposed to for it. We didn't really get into the merits any, but then kind of at the end of the call, James Waddell spoke up and said, well, can I just put a marker down to come back and discuss this further? And so that's what this is. There's been no textual changes to it. It's just highlighted as a topic for further discussion to throw out the, I guess, pros and cons of including it for discussion among the larger working group. So I suggest we start with that. And, I mean, I'm happy to go first in terms of discussing the pros and cons of it.
Unless Kathy has something to add to that particular point, we can take these one by one and hopefully move relatively quickly through these documents.
Yeah, actually, this is Kathy. I do have a procedural set of changes, procedural question to raise, which is, again, we're looking at a document that came out last night from staff that hasn't gone through. The sub-team has been going back and forth with a number of changes and questions. So we can jump into debating pieces of the report as posted by staff. But the textual changes, and I guess I don't understand what that means, because there are textual changes throughout the document, not just in one section. But the one we're talking about here that we haven't really talked about is nominal cost, whether the nominal cost should be passed on to the requester. So when it says that all the comments were on one side, we have a number of comments that had to do with the reasonable cost and access to proxy privacy services. So I don't know. Frankly, I would throw this back to the sub-team right now. I'm not sure, you know, I'm happy to get input for the working group, but from the working group's perspective, should let you know that a lot of this is still being debated within the sub-team and that the text that came out may not be what would ultimately be recommended after the debate goes back and forth. But there are a number of very selected changes here that have an enormous impact. And so you can talk about it. We can talk about it here, or you can ask the sub-team to write a report, or more people can come into the sub-team, or we can create another avenue for discussing what really is the center of our report, which is Annex E, the center of our working group presentation, is really Annex E. And right now, there are thousands of comments on various parts of it. Thanks.
Thanks, Kathy. And I don't want to force this if it's not ready for prime time. But at the same time, we need to make some headway. I see Steve's got his hand and Todd. So let's hear from them, and then we'll decide whether to leave that point or whether we need to put this whole piece aside for today. Steve?
Yeah, thanks. This is Steve Metalitz. The vast majority of the change of the things that are marked here as changes were presented to this working group by the sub-team 2 weeks ago. So they're not new. And what's on the right-hand side are the things that have changed in this document since then. It's been 2 weeks. We asked the sub-team to go back and look at this. Sub-team members said they really wanted to discuss verifiable evidence, which was one of the main topics that we talked about 2 weeks ago. And I'm reluctant to send this back to the sub-team because I don't think the sub-team is producing. And it may be more efficient to just have this discussion here now in the working group. Obviously, I'd love to hear more from other sub-team members on this, but I think the two options are either to discuss it now or to ask the sub-team to provide its final report by Friday. I don't really see any other options than those two if we are going to actually have a meaningful face-to-face meeting in Dublin and meet our timetable. Thank you.
Thanks, Steve. I see Todd and James. Kathy, is that an old hand? I think it is. Let's hear from Todd and James, and I'll have a think about what we're going to do here.
Yeah, this is Todd. I agree with Steve. I don't see any downside in discussing the open issues on the larger working group call today, and to the extent that people that aren't on the subteam have points that the subteam then needs to go back and consider and debate among ourselves, that's the only way we're going to find out. I don't understand the suggestion of taking this back under subteam consideration.
Thanks, Todd. James?
Hi, James Gannon. So I would go along with the suggestion of taking this to the full working group. However, I wouldn't agree that we need to be finishing this out today. There's still a lot of work to be done on this. It's still not in a position where we have agreement on the content of this, and there's certainly more than an hour's work left in it. But I would agree that I think this is at the stage where it needs to come back to some substantive and serious discussion on the full working group.
Graham, are you on mute?
Graham? In the chat.
All right, I'll go ahead while addressing that. I mean, it appears from the chat that most of the comments are in agreement. Let's discuss with the stipulation that James just identified that this isn't necessarily final. So on this issue of costs, 1B3, more of the comments that we reviewed noted opposition to this than not. And I think the kind of substantive argument on it, just to lay it out, is as best, you know, as simple as I can make it. When you're looking at a privacy proxy service, that's a contract between two parties, the provider and the customer. They are the two parties that are under the contract. They're the two parties that enjoy any benefit of the contract. To the extent that there are any costs that are generated by them doing so, it makes sense for them to divide those costs between them however they see fit, to instead pass off the cost to a third party, namely a requester, that had no input on the decision to enter into that contract and gets no benefit from that contract, it just doesn't make sense. That's at least my position.
Okay, Graham, if Graham's not back on, why don't we go to Kathy, who I think had her hand up, and then I
yep.
see Holly's hand, and others can follow in the queue. So, Kathy, go ahead, and Graham, if you reemerge, I'll pass the baton back. Yeah.
Terrific. Thanks. Just to lay out the other side of the argument is that providers have expressed concern over the cost of providing these accreditation services, what we're going to be asking them to do. And especially with scale and scope, some of the providers could be on the hook for a lot of new staff. Customers have commented widely on the concern over affordable access to proxy privacy services, that if they are raised to the level of, say, attorney confidentiality, then that would be a problem. So normally in other environments, let's say you file in court as a third party, you pay the filing fees. And here, too, it seems very reasonable to be asking, and the counter is to be asking those requesting services to pay a reasonable or nominal cost for them. Thanks.
Holly, go ahead. Or did you want to?
Oh, no. I agree with Kathy and with the comments that are in the chat, which is essentially the cost that we're talking about is because there has been a request for information that otherwise wouldn't be available. So essentially it is the requester that is seeking something additional, and that's why we were talking about where the cost should lie. But that point's been made well. Thank you.
Okay. Okay, I've put myself in the queue, and I guess I have a practical question here. So this language says there'll be a standardized nominal cost recovery fee. Who would standardize that? I'd like to ask the proponents of this language, who would standardize that? Who would determine whether it's nominal? And I say that just because I know the answer to the question is not going to be ICANN. So how would this be standardized, and how would the nominalness, if you will, of the fee and determining that it doesn't serve as an unreasonable barrier, which is also in there, how would those be determined and enforced? So I'll just put that question out there, and any opponent who wishes to answer that can do so. Holly, is that a new hand? Or okay, maybe James then. We'll go on to James Gannon. But who's in the queue? Go ahead, James. James Gannon, are you with? Oh, there you go. Are you off mute now?
Authorization. We don't see any pushback. Yes, you got me now.
James, you're breaking up. At least I'm not hearing you very well. Could you?
Yes, so I.
James is passing. I think we have a technical problem here. That so James can get back in the queue at some point. McKaylee, go ahead.
Thanks, McKaylee, for the record. I'm not sure exactly how one would decide a standardized cost. I mean, that is obviously a bit of a problem. But having said that, as a service provider, I would like to have the ability to levy a fee should I need to or should I wish to. So, for example, if you were to look at our terms of service around various things, we have in our terms of service that we can levy a fee on clients who constantly generate spam cop reports, just as an example. Generally speaking, we don't do it, but if they keep on abusing the system, we have it in our terms of service, we can. If I'm getting like one request every 6 months, then it's going to cost me more to charge somebody than it would be for me just to do whatever is required. But if I have somebody who is constantly sending us reports every bloody day, I would probably want to have the ability to charge them. So my main thing is just making sure that I can levy a fee on these people who are asking, who are sending things for me. I mean, Steve, the thing is that, yes, I can levy fees on my clients, but if you or somebody else wants me to go off and jump through hoops to provide you with all sorts of extra information about my clients for whatever reason, then I'm going to charge you a handling fee for that, much in the same way as we would for somebody who wants, I don't know, to get us to spend hours pulling out logs out of servers for whatever reason to deal with some kind of, you know, third-party civil court case or something like that. I mean, generally speaking, we probably don't charge it, but we need to have the ability to be able to charge it should we need to. Thanks.
Thanks, McKaylee. I think, let's see. Holly, is that a new hand, or if not, could you take it down?
No.
It's a new hand. Go ahead. Go ahead, Holly.
Okay, what I'm making and saying in the chat, which is we're not talking about clients versus non-clients. If you're asking for information, automatically, you're a client. And therefore, it's really up to the person who's got the information to say, well, I will charge you, and we can use the term cost recovery or something like that so that, in fact, you're not making a profit out of it, but cost recovery. And taking McKaylee's point, if you are constantly harassing him for information, then probably you are going to be incurring costs. But I don't think it's fair to say non-client in this stage because, in fact, you are seeking a service, and the service is the provision of information. And I think that there should be some kind of nominal cost recovery for that. Thanks.
Okay. That's an interesting concept of what constitutes a client. McKaylee, is that a new hand?
Yes, it is. Thanks again, McKaylee, for the record. Just very briefly,
I'm not sure if it's the same in every single jurisdiction which has data privacy and protection laws, but in this jurisdiction, Ireland, anybody can come to a company and ask them to produce a copy of the records that are held, and there is the ability for us to levy a fee. I think there's a maximum set. Somebody like James might know the exact amount. But there is a bit, we have the person doing that has the company providing that data can ask the person, the requester, to pay a nominal fee. It's the same with freedom of information requests. You can submit them to government departments and other agencies that are subject to FOI, and they have the ability to levy a charge. Again, it comes back to the ability. It doesn't mean that they're going to. And I think this is something that others have mentioned in the chat as well. I mean, it's not a great case of saying that everybody's going to charge everybody for every single thing. I mean, if we get, you know, a very simple request from somebody in relation to a court case involving one of our clients, and it takes one of my staff 5 or 10 minutes to deal with it, fine. But if it involves going off and digging out, you know, archived files, extracting them, doing stuff with them, then, you know, that's a very different set of things, because that's providing, as I think Holly said, it's providing a service to somebody. Thanks.
Thanks, Michele.
I have Alex.
I also have an echo.
I also have
Alex, go ahead.
Hi, it's Alex. Is it me causing that echo? I hope not. Can you hear me?
Yep.
Yeah.
No.
Alex, go ahead. Alex, we're not here. I'm not hearing you. Let's go ahead to Kathy. We'll come back to Alex.
Okay. So, again, I wasn't sure we should be doing all this word stuff here, but if we are, then looking at the paragraph B, subpoint 3, what I'd recommend in light of the current discussion is taking out the word standardized. So because, you know, some providers, what we're hearing is may charge, may not charge. If it's a small amount of time, they may not charge. So assessing a, remove the word standardized, nominal cost recovery fee for processing complaint submissions. So we're not saying what it is, but we're saying nominal and cost recovery. This is not a profit center. You can't make a profit out of it. These are pretty standardized terms. You could replace it with a reasonable fee, but not making it mandatory, but certainly making it optional. Thanks.
Thank you. Paul?
Thank you. Paul McGrady for the record. My concern, of course, is that without it being standardized, and I agree with Steve, I don't have any idea who would do that, that the word nominal is open for negotiation or abuse, and again, there's no way without getting inside the provider's books to know whether or not if the fee charged is in fact cost recovery. And so, what again, my concern is if the nominal fee is $1,000, that will cause you know, people to flock to a particular provider because it's more difficult for concerned parties to obtain the information. If everybody were you know, good actors, which, you know, 99.9% with a line over it are, wouldn't be an issue, but there's always that 0.01% that will find this and will certainly find a way to abuse it. So I don't know that we can, if we're going to include this provision, I think we have to do more than use vague terms. The problem is I just don't know how I can do that. But in any event, that's just a question. How do we prevent the $1,000 charge or the $10,000 charge? Thank you.
Thank you, Paul. Alex, are you back with us? Or maybe you're going to say something in the chat. No, okay. So Alex has a comment in the chat. Um, Okay, let me just draw this comment to a close, really by posing two questions again to the providers here. One is, since I'm not sure we have an answer on who would determine whether it's nominal cost recovery or whether it's standardized, if that stays in. So one question is, how do you do it now? I mean, you receive requests now for people to disclose information about your customers. Do you charge them? I mean, in some cases, you do that. So do you charge them, and how do you calculate that? That's one question. The other question is, if this is in here as a nominal cost recovery fee, and if it's not standardized set in advance, then that means that if someone encounters the $1,000 fee that Paul talked about, they go to ICANN and ICANN compliance and say, this provider is in violation of these accreditation standards because it's assessing a fee that's more than a nominal cost recovery fee. So is that more palatable for providers? I'll just pose those two questions. If anyone wants to respond to them now, then please do so. I see Michele's hand is up. Alex's hand is still up, but I don't think he's able to speak, so maybe you could take the hand down. Michele, go ahead.
Thanks, Steve. It's Michele for the record again. I suppose the main concern I have is, without some language in here, are we going to end up in some kind of weird circular discussion or argument for the next 20 years? If, for example, you submit loads and loads of requests to one of my companies, and we end up having to levy a fee to be able to service those in a timely fashion. Or put another way, you know, if by omitting any reference to fees, by not explicitly stating that it's going to be done for free, are we still able to charge for it? I mean, I think one interpretation would say yes, because there's nothing in here to say that we can't charge for it, that we can't do some kind of cost recovery. My concern is, if we don't put something in, then if somebody needs to charge a fee because somebody is abusing the system or the requests that they're sending in require whatever, that we just have that ability to be able to levy a fee. That's all I'm personally asking. I'm not into this entire thing about what constitutes excessive fees and all that, but I think that, again, it's a very hard question to answer. I mean, what's excessive for me might not be excessive for you, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Thanks.
Okay, thanks, Michele. I think we've had a good ventilation of the viewpoints on this, including the questions that would have to be addressed if this language were kept in. So let me ask, I don't see anybody else in the queue. Let me ask Todd to continue down the other changes that were made in this last, or were proposed, because as pointed out, the sub-team hasn't approved this, in this last go-around. So Todd, could you go back to the next one, the next substantive ones?
Right. So the next big substantive open issue is, it's easiest to start with 2A, 6B, but then this particular issue then gets repeated in 2B and 2C, and it's basically the new language about requester averments as to what it's going to do with the data. So there was new language that we as a working group kind of went over in that September 15th call, and a lot of people raised questions about how feasible this was. I know there was also discussion of indemnification as kind of another way to look at this particular issue. I don't know that there is necessarily anything new or any progress in what you're looking at now, just to say this is still an open issue as to whether this language gets to what it is that we were trying to get at or if there's a better alternative.
Okay, thank you, Todd. So I see one issue was whether a requester can keep the data to associate with other information about the registrant for future or other requests. I think that was one topic that came up in the working group discussion here. And then there was the indemnification question. So I'll open the queue on this if people have comments. Let me just open the queue if people have any comments on this. Again, I don't know that there were textual changes here. I see there were comments added by Mary in the document, which are not visible, unfortunately, here. But they basically get to those two points that are summarized in the right-hand pod. Any comments on that? I see Kathy has her hand up. Kathy, go ahead.
Okay. First, can you point out what – can you lock the document on the screen to where you are? Because and just to note that the textual changes that are proposed currently here, even though we've seen them before, are certainly part of the discussion that's taking place in the active discussion that's taking place in the subteam. But so in terms of indemnification, there's a real question, and it was raised, you'll see it coming through in subteam 4's comments as well, or review of comments, which is what happens when something goes wrong. When the requester agrees to be bound for the use of XYZ to limit their use of the data, and then they go and they put it on their blog or they're harvesting. They ask a number of requests to a number of different providers, and they harvest the data and create databases. A lot of people used to, in the old days, it was great to go after unlisted cell phone numbers and create databases of them. This is unlisted data that's ripe for the picking. There were comments that there's no ramification for doing that, that there's no penalty. And so indemnification, a bond, these are all important because the requester can abuse the data just as anyone else can. Thanks.
Okay, so I think your first point is addressed by this language that was presented on the 15th about retention and first of all, it's been addressed by since the beginning about what uses are allowed. So there is a question of enforcement of that, which we'll, I'm sure we'll come to later in this discussion. Indemnification, so that's where I guess indemnification comes in your Okay, let me ask if there are any other comments on this, particularly on the points raised in the right-hand pod about retaining it to associate with future requests. I mean, is there objection to that? In other words, is there agreement that would be encompassed by what's in here in B2, retaining it as long as necessary to achieve the objectives outlined, or do we need to have a specific provision on that? I'm seeing James Gannon and McKaylee. James?
Thanks, Steve. So as I said last week, I would be strongly opposed to having the ability to start building internal databases, which is essentially my reading of that language. I understand that makes life a bit more difficult for requesters, and I'm sympathetic to that issue, but I'm much more sympathetic to internal databases being built and matrices of, you know, known bad registrants, and, you know, it just goes down a rabbit hole that I don't think we should be going down.
Okay, let me just ask on that, how would that be reconciled with 2B5 above that says you can block requester access if there are numerous requests that are identical, the same domain name, same intellectual property, and the same requester. Would this interfere with that ability because you wouldn't be able to retain that data, or is that sufficient because you could still request it about the same domain name the same intellectual property, wouldn't know whether it was the same request or the same registrant or not. Does that make any difference? That is this question for James, but let's move on to we have a queue here. We have McKaylee and Stephanie, and maybe we back to that question. McKaylee.
Thanks, McKaylee. I'd be wary of, you know, giving people unlimited retention of the data. That is problematic. I mean, again, there's a couple of strings to this. I mean, you're talking about allegations without full due process. I mean, whoever is alleged to have done whatever, it hasn't actually gone through a proper process, so it's an allegation. If they're a corporate entity, a company, their rights are very different from that from individuals. But when it comes to individuals, you know, there's problems. I mean, for us as an Irish company, to give out individuals' data to third parties, and there's a lot of restrictions about where that data can go. And while up until last week, one did have the safe harbor, that's now very much up in the air. I'm sure Stephanie and other people can speak to that more knowledgeably than I can. But there are serious concerns around data privacy for private individuals with respect to the retention of data. Be very, very careful about that. Thank you.
Thanks, McKaylee. I see Graham in the chat. Graham, do you want to retake the gavel here? You can speak up if you can. I'll continue to sub here for the moment. Graham, is that you?
Oh, it is me, but I'll let you finish this point out, Steve, and then maybe take up the next section. Thanks.
Okay, great. Thank you. We have Stephanie and Kathy in the queue. Stephanie, go ahead.
Thanks very much, Stephanie Perrin, for the record. I hope you can hear me. I was going to address 7C3. It's nice, and, you know, as McKaylee has pointed out, data protection applies. But my point is really, you're getting data, the requester is getting this data that is bound to confidentiality by contract between the customer and the service provider. And it seems to me that there has to be a contract between the service provider and the requester that also respects not just data protection law, but the confidentiality of third-party information, whether they're a group or an organization or an NGO or a company. So that's commercial confidential information, and we need a clause that discusses that they're getting it under contract and that there are terms to this contract and that those terms have to meet what I would call best practice of data protection law, regardless of whether in each particular jurisdiction it applies to commercial entities. Are you following my logic here? Thanks.
Thanks, Stephanie. Kathy.
Hi. For this section, B2, I would recommend going back to the original language that we had agreed originally that the requester would retain the data for particular purposes. One was to contact the customer regarding further action, and the other was and so actually 2 is just redundant. But the idea of retaining the customer's data for as long as it's necessary to achieve the objectives, as a lawyer, you can argue it's always necessary to hold that data to achieve the objectives and future objectives and related objectives. There's no reason you wouldn't be holding the data for as long as you possibly could under B2. The other thing is the reference that goes back to 2A, 6B, I. I wanted to discourage these kind of references, and I'd like to take it out here. Again, going back to original language or just deleting this section completely. One of the comments that we got, again, in subteam 4, is that it's completely impossible for a layman to understand what we're talking about here. This is very legalese. And, in fact, all it's doing is referencing the section right above it. Let's write in English. Let's not write in legalese. And let's make sure this is clear to people who speak English and to people who don't. So I would just delete this whole section. Thanks.
Okay, so you're suggesting going back to the original language of Annex E on this?
Oh, we're just deleting this little subpoint 2 section since I think it's already considered in subpoint 1. But I think the language here is dangerous. I think it massively extends what we intended.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Is there anybody else that wants to comment on this? We've had a concrete suggestion here, which I think is we ought to consider, which would be either go back to the original Annex E language or simply delete point 2 here. I see James Gannon's hand up. James, go ahead. Yeah, Stephanie, is that an old hand or a new hand? James, go ahead. And
hold on. Thanks, Steve. Yeah, I actually quite like Kathy's suggestion, and possibly with the modification in 61 to only use and retain customers' contact details, blah, blah, blah. I think that could be a good way out of the complex nature of what we're going into. I think I could sign on to that.
Okay. So that's a good suggestion. Okay, so... Let's. Why don't we move on to the next point in the right-hand pod, and I'm going to pass the gavel back to Graham and simultaneously call on Todd to walk us through the next set of changes here, proposed changes.
Thanks, Steve. So now we go down to Section 3. The first part is 3B. You know, we had a little bit of discussion on the timing on our last call, 5 calendar days. We had some discussion about this secure communication channels and heard from James Waddell and I think Graham about why encrypted email is not administratively feasible. We heard from James Waddell about why disclosing some subset of the information, namely name, mailing address, and contact information for service of process as opposed to just the broader set of the contact information that would ordinarily appear in the publicly accessible WHOIS database was problematic, and so that's why we went back to the original formulation on that. We had discussion about shall versus encouraged but not required to, and the general consensus on the call last time seemed to be that shall was preferable, encouraged but not required to, kind of eviscerated the point. And then we had some discussion on the last call about whether C4 should be optional or mandatory, and then whether C6 was duplicative of what's in 5. So that's kind of the posture of where we are now. I think Kathy had identified some other language in 3 that she wanted to discuss, and I'll kind of pass the mic to her to raise that.
Actually, I'm going to recommend we deal with Section B and Section C separately because I think they raise a host of issues. So let's just go with Section B. The 5 calendar days was, I think, generally agreed to. But notice the change with the word shall. Within 5 calendar days after receiving the customer's response or 1 calendar day after the time for customer's response has passed, service provider shall. And that's replacing is encouraged but not required to take one of the following actions. So let me raise this with the providers, and I'm going to raise another one more smaller issue, I think, before I give up the mic. But, you know, that shall. Think about that shall in the week between Christmas and New Year's. Think about that shall period. And the you're only given 2 options, really, disclose the data or tell them in detail why not. So I think that shall is actually an enormous change. You're going from encourage, but now it's mandatory. And then the secure communication channels. If we take out channels, it may be better, secure communication. I've talked with a number of people recently about how credit cards, how lawyers are communicating credit cards and confidential data like social security numbers online. And, you know, it's easy to put in a password on a Word file or an Adobe file and send that password via another email. Sending this kind of data in open email, like a battered women's shelter, if God forbid that happens, that has to be disclosed or is disclosed, is probably not a good idea. Sending any of this data in open email is probably not a good idea. But I think there are secure communication paths that are cheap and easy. Thanks, but I'm interested in the discussion.
Thank you, Kathy. Hopefully everyone can hear me at this time.
Yep.
Yes?
Yes.
Hooray! Wonderful. I suspect that cheap and easy isn't actually secure, which, you know, it's only sort of superficially secure, Kathy, and maybe that's problematic. I don't think there's a problem with considering secure communication as a best practice, but as a provider, I find that problematic to mandate. As for another one of your points, as for the shall, so it's either they disclose or they write back not. I'm curious as to what some of the other opportunities might be there. If it's not shall, is it, you know, you ignore the request entirely? What would the alternative responses be? I see Todd's got his hand up and Steve's got his hand up. So let's hear from Todd and then Steve. Todd?
I just wanted to make a point of clarification on the shall versus encouraged but not required to. Shall was what was in the initial report. We only received one comment suggesting changing it to encouraged but not required to. We brought that to the broader working group in our previous September 15th call and said, look, this is a language that had been in there before that nobody had really had any issue with. This one individual commenter has recommended changing it. We're bringing that to you in the sake of full disclosure so that we can talk about it, but that the consensus on the call at the time seemed to be no, you know, that kind of defeats the purpose, and we went back to shall. I you want to make sure that that posture is clear as to what the default baseline is here. Thanks.
Thanks, Todd. I thought I saw Steve in the queue, but it looks like his hand is down, and I think that's an old hand from Kathy, so let's go to James Gannon.
Hi, thanks, Graham. So, secure communication channels, this is one of my pet projects. So, I think the language that we have here is sufficiently broad that it encompasses a number of things that even the smallest provider should be able to do. So saying here that, you know, the provider must set up an OTRX MPP server, you know, this could be anything from, you know, setting up a PGP email, which I know people don't want to use. It could be ensuring that data is released through a HTTPS secured portal. You know, we're not specifying a single technology or a level of security here where we're mandating a minimum best practice, which I think is the least we should be doing if we're going to be transmitting people's personal information between two parties. I think that it's a fair ask as a minimum without specifying individual technologies or levels of security.
Thanks, James. I think what it does do is it excludes regular email. I don't want to push too hard, but I'd be curious to hear from other providers on that. Holly's asking in the chat, as for the other question, Regal, is the provider doing nothing okay? And now I see Steve's got his hand up again. Steve? Go ahead.
Just on the secure communications channel point, if we're going to do this, we need a definition of that phrase. And so James said, talk a little bit just now in his intervention about that. Maybe he could turn that into a suggested definition so it would be clearer what he's talking about there. And, you know, again, I it sort of depends on what is encompassed within that as to whether this is feasible, but if James could circulate a proposed definition of that phrase, that would be great. And if there's one that's generally accepted, that's even better. Thank you.
Uh, That's a good suggestion. Thank you, Steve. I see James has got his hand up in response, and I still haven't heard anyone else on the show. James?
Thanks, Ryan. Very brief. I'm happy to circulate a piece of text, but I think we should, in the interests of the providers, we should try and avoid trying to put definitions into the actual text. Then we're opening up the same issue that we're going to have, is that well, we're then specifying specific security measures, and we're going to have to then build on those as the years go on, and we'll have to make sure that they're updated and everything else. I think that's an ask too far. I'd love to do it, but I think it's an ask too far. Happy to do something for the list, though.
Thanks, James. Michele?
Agreeing with James G, I mean, the specifying exact methods for doing anything, be it communicating or doing anything else, is a bad idea. I mean, look at the world we live in today compared to the world we lived in a couple of years ago. Communications methods change, the technology changes. Changing the language in one of these in a policy document is going to be a slow and painful process. So keeping things high level, general, not getting into specifics is always better. Thanks.
Thanks, Michele. If I can come back to you as a provider, are you happy with secure communication channel language as is?
I don't have a problem with secure. Secure is fine. I just don't want anybody specifying what constitutes secure. So, I mean, as others have said, secure could be, in certain circumstances, a phone call, it could be a fax, it could be carrier pigeon. I mean, you know, there's a lot of different things that might constitute secure. And it's up to, and depending on the size and scale of your operations, which one of them suits is going to vary. I've no issue with people using secure. That's fine. But I wouldn't want anybody saying you have to use whatever, because that could be really bad.
Okay. Thanks, Michele. My screen just refreshed, so I've got to scroll back down to where we were. Where was that? and now I see Kathy have hands up. Kathy, if you would.
I was actually going to ask if you wanted to move on to C, but if Steve wants to talk to B, I'm fine with that.
This is Steve. My only additional comment on B is if Michele's okay with it on behalf of the providers, I don't see the problem, but I think the danger is that they would conclude that the only secure, you know, it's subject to abuse. If it's carrier pigeon, if it's hand delivery to my office and it's going to take a week to do that, that's not going to be acceptable. So, again, this will be an issue that would be subject to ICANN compliance if they sent it using a method that was dilatory on the pretext that that was the only secure communication channel. But in general, I don't, you know, I'm happy to leave that.
Thanks, Steve. I think many of us are in a similar place on that, that it's I would love to see it as a best practice. I have a tough time excluding email. So that might be something to ponder a little bit more between the people who care about that, and maybe providers can have a discussion, see if we can bring something back on that. Kathy, you wanted to move on to C, and maybe it's time to do that.
Okay. Moving on to C, reasons disclosure can be reasonably refused. So I decided to read some of this. Disclosure can be reasonably refused for reasons consistent with the general policy stated herein, including, and the brackets are still there for without limitation, any of the following. And now if you look at subpoint 2, a number of the options have been deleted, and I wanted to point that out to this group and see if we're comfortable with that deletion. It's certainly a part of the sub-team's ongoing discussion, to put it tactfully. So that the customer has objected to the disclosure and has provided, and then options adequate, sufficient, compelling, have all been deleted. And it's limited now to a reasonable basis for believing that it is not infringing the requester's claimed intellectual property rights and or that its use of the claimed intellectual property is defensible. Similarly, in three, the provider has found, and the terms adequate, sufficient, compelling have been deleted. The provider has a reasonable basis for believing that the customer is not infringing the requester's claimed intellectual property and or that the customer's use of the claimed intellectual property is defensible. Reasonable basis is a fairly high standard. It's certainly higher than adequate or sufficient, at least in my understanding. And so let me put it out there that, are providers comfortable? Are customers comfortable? Are registrants comfortable with this new, with this proposed higher standard? This was based, as I understand it, you can correct me if I'm wrong, Todd, this is coming in from the comments of the International Trademark Association and other intellectual property. I know from the non-commercial side that we were much more comfortable with adequate or sufficient. There's a real concern about providers becoming judge and jury of infringement and intellectual property issues, and same with registrants. They're not expert in a lot of these intellectual property issues. They will give their best response, but it may or may not respond, rise to the level of an intellectual property infringement defense. Thanks. I hope that made sense.
Thanks, Kathy. And I spent so long fumbling around for microphones, the time's gotten away from me, so we've only got about 2 minutes. I'll interject very briefly, and then we've got Todd and James, and then we'll have to close the queue because we're running very quickly out of time. Reasonable to me, and I'm not a lawyer, sounds reasonable. I couldn't see us refusing for an unreasonable reason. And to me, reasonable fits adequate, sufficient, and or compelling. And so it feels okay to me. But I'm very curious to hear from Todd and James, both of you, very quickly, if you could, please.
This is Todd. My point is not substantive, but procedural. These are not changes that the subteam has made or suggested. These were two alternative formulations that the initial report put out for public comment, meaning, do you prefer A or do you prefer B? And we received more public comments preferring what is included here versus what is not. I just want to make sure that that is kind of understood by the broader working group. This is not some sort of sub-team formulation or anything like that. Thanks.
Thanks, Todd. James, last word.
Thanks, Graham. Very briefly, so similar to Kathy, unsurprisingly, I would prefer to have a look at where we could possibly use the old language, and also we have to take into account that we had a huge amount of concern around due process and a certain level of evidence, and there's a number of things around the public comments here that may not have been talking specifically to this text, but will be talking to the issue here. We need to take those into account and go forward looking at language.
Okay. Thanks, James. That brings us to 11 o'clock. We've made some progress through this document, but it certainly feels like we've got a little bit more work to do on the annex, and certainly some other pieces of work to get to that we didn't get to as a report from Subteam 4. And so I thank everyone for coming today and participating. Apologies again for the audio issues. And it's been a little bit quiet on the mailing list, so let's make sure we're in there and engaged, and maybe we can make a little progress there. Thanks, all. We'll talk to you next week.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you all.
Thank you, everyone. The meeting has been adjourned, and the audio will now be disconnected. Thank you for joining today's call, and enjoy the rest of your morning, afternoon, or evening. Thank you.